Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight, and it's always a pleasure to talk to her, is Polly Atkin. She's an award-winning poet and nonfiction writer whose work focuses on nature, place, and disability. And tonight we're talking about her newest collection of poetry, Emergency Dream. Polly, welcome back to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you.
It's so lovely to be back again. Thank you for talking to me again.
Who is or was Alice Wong?
So Alice was a disability activist and writer who was just an extraordinary figure. She was so full of enthusiasm and care and was a brilliant writer and editor, and edited some amazing collections called Disability Visibility and Disability Intimacy.
Wow.
And was just a galvanizing force for the disability community.
But she's not alive still?
No, she died, I'm going to forget the date.
Okay.
Last year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. These poems are amazing. And they didn't, for me, they didn't read like any other poems I've come across. First of all, it's just my ignorance, but I haven't read a lot of poetry that addresses the life of a chronic person or disabilities.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are other collections, I just have not come across them. But that's an extraordinary thing to read. And you know that, right?
Yeah. And it's something that I've kind of set out deliberately to do because there aren't that many. There are some. There's some amazing poets writing about their experience of chronic illness. There's also, one of the amazing things, as with all of literary history, is if you go back and you actually scratch the surface, most of the poets who are most famous from the past were chronically ill. You just don't necessarily know it. So Emily Dickinson,
right,
famously chronically ill. All of these amazing poets of the past, famously chronically ill, but we wouldn't necessarily read them that way. But it's different deliberately writing about things that maybe in the past we wouldn't really have been encouraged to or allowed to as well.
Writing poetry like that for you, is it cathartic or are you on a mission to try to convey some of the feelings that you have?
A mixture of both of those. So really fundamentally for me, poetry is about communication.
Okay.
So I suppose communication and understanding, that it's a way of thinking a thought or a feeling through and then communicating that beyond you as well. So I first started writing poetry very seriously when I was really ill as a teenager, and it was a way of trying to understand what was happening to me when I didn't know what was happening and didn't have any words for it, didn't have any, it was a long way from diagnosis and didn't have any kind of sense of how to think through what was happening and my kind of new isolation from myself, really. So it's always been for me that kind of way of trying to reach towards understanding, a bit like interpreting a dream, really. But then as soon as you write it down, it takes on this other life and becomes this way of communicating that with other people as well.
Let me ask you this. I'm fascinated by people who are poets, who are accomplished poets like yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a weird thing to decide to do.
And yeah, it is.
You have to be a non-poet to understand that. I know I can't write poetry, but I do appreciate good poetry. And it's such a strange thing. When you write poetry, talk to me about how different that is for you, or maybe it's the same, from writing prose.
It's kind of the same. And I think I've only realized this over the course of many years, but I kind of have a similar process for writing them both, and that they both have to start with the voice in my head, really. So I can have an idea of what I want to write about. So there's lots of different ways to approach a poem. Sometimes literally a line will almost appear like a earworm that you have to get down.
Is it something that you've overheard or a piece?
Yeah, like a voice that's come to you from the ether almost.
Oh, wow.
Like a strain of music, mm-hmm, only it's music and words.
And is it sometimes you pick up things from other sources that you've read and expand on that?
Sometimes, but more it's kind of... For me, it's like a internal narrator, which it, that this is what I realized that all of my writing really is. It's like an internal narrator, and sometimes that almost gets turned off if I'm too busy or too tired, and it has to. I have to let it come back again before it can do my writing for me.
I love hearing this. You know, I think every poet has a different approach to this, and this is what I'm realizing too. At what point in your life were you comfortable calling yourself a poet? I think everybody writes poetry in their teenage years.
Yeah.
But it takes a lot of gumption and nerve to go, yeah, I'm a poet, to be able to say that out loud. It's like coming out.
Well, yeah. It is. But I think because I was very ignorant of kind of etiquette around these things, I think I didn't realize how gauche it was. I suppose.
I didn't say it was gauche. No, Polly, don't misunderstand me. I just think it's a bold statement to make.
Yeah, it's a bold thing to do, but people do think I think generally in society, people think it's odd, and I didn't realize it was odd, though, like I think so many things in life. So I first wrote that I wanted to be, and forgive me because I think I must have grown up in the 19th century, but when I was five, I have a creative writing book when I was asked what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I said that I wanted to be a teacher and a poetess and an actress.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a precocious little kid you were.
Exactly. Horrific. I also said I wanted to be a grandmother, but not a mother, which was an interesting concept.
You know what? If we could discover a way to do that, I think it's gold. Because I'll tell you, I'm a grandfather, and I'll tell you, it's incredible to be a grandparent. And
I think I had that in mind. I think I was thinking of my granny and how amazing she was and how much I loved her, and just thinking, yes, this is clearly the best job.
Oh yeah, you get all the fun and then they go home.
Yeah. So somehow I had it in my head. So
wow.
Nobody in my family is literary in that way.
Wow.
But I had it in my head that you could be a poet, even though I didn't meet a living poet till I was in my 20s. I didn't know poets were alive. I knew there were lots of poets in books, and most of them had died a long time ago. I didn't know that they existed in the world, and yet I still wanted to be one. So I was quite comfortable, like, wandering around calling myself a poet without realizing that there might be other poets who might judge me for that.
I love that. Now, talk to me about the difference for you, though. You write these tremendous prose books. Do you set aside a special time during the day to write? Is writing prose like on a deadline? You know you have to get this done. Is poetry is not writing for a deadline? But talk to me about the difference between the two for you.
So, this is the thing. In some ways, they're kind of similar. So what I've realized over time is that I write prose in a way that's probably a little bit unusual and probably quite annoying. For anyone working with me, in that I have to, a bit like writing a poem, I have to wait until the way to write it emerges for me. So I can do all of the research. And, you know, poems come in different ways, too. Some poems are research poems that I know what I want to write about. I have to look lots of things up. Mm. But even so, I still have to wait for the music of it, the kind of voice of it, to come through on its own time. And prose is exactly the same. So I think I probably, with every project, whether it's a small poem or a full-length prose book, 90% of the time I spend working on it, it's thinking and percolating and mulling over, and 10% of the time is the actual writing that happens later on in the process. So with prose, I have to do all of this thinking and then wait for the way to write it to appear, and then I'm like, aha! Now I can do it.
How about editing and revising?
Oh, and yeah.
Is it the same for both things? It just seems like it wouldn't be for poetry.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very similar process in some ways. The kind of winnowing that happens with editing and thinking, does this really need to be here? Is this in the right place? It's just on a much bigger scale with prose. And both of them, for me, are very oral things. So having really started publishing with poetry, I'm used to reading my work out when I'm both when I'm writing it and when I'm editing it. So the sound of things is very important as well. and the rhythm and the way it all kind of fits together. So I'm doing that as part of the editing process too, and thinking, as I say, does this word really fit here? Is this the best version of this? Is this making sense? As well as, is this in the right order?
How about revising older poems, like poems from years ago? Do you do that?
I try not to. In some ways, I kind of think it's cheating a little bit. I can understand why people do it. And so Simon Armitage is just having, I think, a 40th anniversary reissue of his first pamphlet out this year. And he did say he had edited a couple of bits, and in that he couldn't resist doing it. And I think it's really interesting when people, inevitably, you look back at your old work and you have different feelings about it. You think, I wouldn't have written that in the same way now. I think sometimes you look at things and think, wow, I wrote that? Okay, that's quite interesting, actually. But I think you have to accept that you in the past was a different person, just as you in the future will be a different person looking back at your work now as well. And I think you have to kind of honor the decisions that were made at the time, unless you weren't happy with it, which I think is a different thing. Like, there are definitely poems I've published in a version that maybe an editor suggested a workaway around something, and I did it, but I wasn't entirely happy with it, and then have wanted to keep working on it. So it hasn't felt finished yet, which is a slightly different thing, I think.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight, always a pleasure to talk to her, Polly Atkin, award-winning poet and nonfiction writer whose work focuses on nature, place, and disability. And we're talking about her newest collection of poetry. It's wonderful. It's powerful. Emergency Dream. Talk to me about the title, Emergency Dream. That really, before I read all the poems, I just sort of did a meditation on the title. And I went into very weird places.
Did you? I love it. Tell me where you went.
No, not on mic. So tell it. Tell me your emergency dream.
Yeah, the title kind of popped up for me. It's the only one of my collections that has a poem which has the same title as the collection, actually. Huh. Most of the time, my titles come from kind of hidden somewhere within a poem. But I gave this poem that is in the book the title Emergency Dream, and as soon as I did, I thought, that's the title of a collection.
Wow.
I just had that feeling straight away that was going to be it, because it... held so much of what I was trying to write about more generally than just within that one poem as well.
Well, let's hear it. Can we hear a poem from the collection?
Yeah. Shall I read? I'll read that title poem, actually.
Okay.
So this is Emergency Dream. There is a path where it is always autumn. Step as soft as you can from the road onto the track through the bracken. Under the moss branch into a different season. You couldn't say when. Even in this hottest summer in history, the ponds dried up into crackle glaze mud and the ghostly trash of the age of industry rising back up. Bog bottles, bog plates, over it all a smell of burning. The path of lichen and fox leaves is cool and damp. Portal to the past. Dream of forgiveness, of rain and recovery. Dream in which all of us get to thrive.
I love the imagery in your poetry. It's very connected to nature. Has your poetry always been that, like that?
Yes and no. I think probably it started that way, but then... When I was 19, 18, I guess, I moved to London.
And so that'll do it.
When I lived there, I was writing about things like the sun never reaching the playground of the school where I worked, you know, things like that. So nature was still kind of there, but in a kind of more sublimated way, I suppose.
That's fascinating. Now, there's a lot of these poems that have to do with the chronic condition and pain. As a matter of fact, there's a poem, I think it's page 15, Pain Metaphors.
Yeah.
That I found fascinating, that poem. trying to explain to somebody else who's not in you, in your body, what you feel, to me seems like an impossible task.
Yeah, completely. So there's a series of poems which are all called pain metaphors, yep. And they get kind of increasingly far from the idea of what a pain metaphor might be as they go on, which is part of that feeling of it just being impossible to describe. Like, what are you doing? How can you describe these things? And it's not going to be understood, even if you do find the words that you think are perfect anyway.
It is interesting, although in one poem you write the word treacle a lot. And yeah. I have to say, I don't think I've read that word since Lewis Carroll.
That's amazing.
I do understand in Britain, treacle is just a regular thing. But for American readers, treacle, can you just explain, this is going to sound silly, and what is treacle?
Yeah, I suppose your closest thing is molasses. So it's treacle's a sugar derivative. It's a really dark, thick, incredibly thick syrup. And I suppose it's quite a common phrase in the UK to say if you're really, really tired that it's like walking through treacle. So you're trying
Got
to
it.
Move
Got
through
it.
This substance, like trying to move through lava, only the lava is kind of sweet and sticky. It's like a kind of sticky glue because it's so dark. It's the kind of thing like because you bake with it and stuff, if you spill it, you're liable to get stuck to everything around you. So the idea of just trying to move through it, but it's almost like moving through a bog as well. It kind of fills back up behind you.
I also love the fact that you have a poem about critics and responding to critics. Talk to me personally about how do you deal with critics of poetry?
Well, it's really difficult because poetry.
Well, first of all, I think how do you?
Well.
Yeah, I mean, it's are they just getting on your case or what? What's the story? I mean.
Yeah, so that poem, I should say, has details of sexual violence in it as well.
Yep, yep.
And I was thinking about, certainly in the UK, I think poetry is such a small world. It's a tiny, tiny world. And like everything, the poetry world in the UK has become increasingly kind of bifurcated. And there are people arguing for a kind of idealized poetry, which is a very kind of pure form of poetry that certain people aren't allowed into. It's probably an argument as old as time because it's the kind of thing that Keats was being told off that he didn't fit the right kind of image and type of poetry in, you know, 1810. So it's not by any means a kind of new feeling.
Now, another unusual thing about this collection of poems is they're grouped under six seasons.
Yeah.
I thought there was only four.
Well, they are seasons as in seasons of a TV show rather than seasons of the year.
That's odd.
So
you are unpredictable.
Yeah, the kind of premise is that we're stuck in an endless plague show, a bit like Walking Dead. So imagine like The Walking Dead, but it's life, and that's where we are. So it's kind of six seasons of this pandemic plague show that keeps going on and on and on somehow.
There is, as in any collection of good poetry that I read, there's always lines that stick with me. And I think this one you cited Jameson under True Poetry, page 100. I woke up and it was political.
Yes. Amazing poem.
Amazing poem. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that. You know, I don't expect a lot of political from you, but sometimes there is. Talk to me about that, and especially in Britain.
Particularly in relation to this collection as well, I suppose underpinning it is this idea that the personal is political. I always have in my head that kind of Audre Lorde, your silence will not save you as well. You know, what are we not talking about? What are we not addressing face on? And part of what I'm trying to think about in this collection particularly is the interconnectedness of different struggles for justice and struggles for rights as well. So it's thinking about disability rights and disability justice, but also climate justice. It's thinking about war and genocide and all of these things that are kind of operating in connection with each other in these kind of interconnected networks, and which all affect the most vulnerabilized people around them as well. So there's a kind of politics running through everything in it, whether it's on the surface or underneath in that way.
There's several recurrent themes throughout your poetry, too. There's a lot about trees, a lot about cats, and a lot about owls. And we've talked before about owls.
Yeah.
There's a really, for me, because I'm a cat person, too. Burying the cat is a really sad poet.
Yeah, it is. It is. It was, the first time that we have lost a cat, she was... the first cat that I've ever... I wanted a cat since I wanted to be a poet when I was five, probably before that. And one acquired us when we moved into this house 11 years ago. She lived with our neighbours and she didn't like their puppy, and then they had a baby. So she moved in with us instead, and then ruled our lives with an iron fist. And she was quite a character. She was... known to everybody in the area and was an astounding kind of queenly figure. And she died 2 Novembers ago.
Oh. Don't go into other details, because there's a poem about this.
There is a poem about it. So, it felt like she deserved her poem. And obviously, you know, some of what I'm doing with poetry as well is trying to invert cliches, and it's very cliche to write cat poems to the point where, you know, poets, when they're judging competitions, would often say, "I throw out any of the poems containing cats," you know, that kind of thing. So I thought, I'm just going to whack a load of cat poems in there.
You also talk about ottering.
Yes.
Now, I see otters fairly regularly.
Sea otters?
No, they're the freshwater otters.
Freshwater otters, lovely, amazing.
This time of the year, they've got they're young and they're sort of going out, and you see them all the time. They are wild. I mean, they're really hilarious, and also they have huge teeth, so they're really sort of scary. But I never knew there was a word called ottering, but of course there is.
Yeah. A lot of swimmers talk about it, so this kind of just floating in that kind of pose that the otters do, where they're just like, wow, you know exactly what it's like. It makes perfect sense when you think about it.
Do you want to try to do another poem?
Yeah. In fact, that might be a good one to do, because it's one of these poems, so like a lot of poems in the book, there's things contained.
Actually, I think we're going to run out of time if we do that. I just realized we're running behind time, so I apologize, and I apologize to the audience.
No,
let's talk more. Name some of your favorite poets.
Oh, poets. At the moment, I've been having a big mood for Layla Chatty, whose collection that came out last year I absolutely adore. And Amy Nezuko Matattle as well. I've just got her new one. In the UK here, I'm loving John McCulloch's new collection. He's just absolutely fabulous. And I was just reading an essay this morning by Jane Hirschfield, who is a perennial favorite of mine as well. But there are just so many. There's a lot of poets who I just think are amazing, doing the most brilliant work.
I don't think we're teaching poetry on the grade school level like we used to.
Yeah, I could believe that.
Because I think you have to train young people to read poetry, to how to sort of embrace that kind of abstraction and artistic vision. And if you don't, I don't think adult people who've not learned about poetry will pick up a poetry book.
It's so interesting, though, that I think there's a lot of fear of poetry. So I've taught in schools at all different levels. And one time I was teaching in a high school precisely because the English teacher hadn't was about to go on maternity leave and hadn't done the poetry module with her students because she was so scared of teaching it.
Wow.
So they kind of left it to me to do it. And actually, the students were fine with it when you kind of presented it to them. But I think sometimes people, including poets themselves, get really scared of how people are going to respond to the idea of poetry. But most people, actually, when you present it to them, aren't anything like as put off as we think they would be, I think.
For those high school students, what kind of poets did you expose them to?
Oh, gosh. So we were doing things like Alfred Tennyson.
Okay. Wow.
So there was a lot of, largely...
Loxley Hall?
Kind of Victorian and Edwardian poetry.
That's wild.
But once they got into it, they were going with it. I think you just have to kind of give people a way in, and then they find their way in.
Do you like doing public readings?
Yeah, I do. I love reading.
Is it because there's an audience that gives you immediate feedback?
Completely. But also, I think poetry is an oral thing. So, like, the poem on the page is a bit like reading manuscripts paper for music sometimes. And it wants to kind of live. It wants to live in the breath and to move between people in that way. And you respond to it differently. You notice different things when it's spoken to when it's on the page. I think both coexist. But it's a beautiful thing to kind of share that sound together.
How often do you publish a collection of poetry?
It really depends on the publisher's schedule, which I don't have much say over. But when my first collection came out in 2017, my second in 2021, and then this year. So about every 5 years, I guess.
And you, in the interim, you do prose?
Yeah, I do prose now, but also I'm writing poetry all the time. So, I mean, as you've seen with this book, there's kind of 6 years that are in the book.
Yeah, it is.
And it just kind of rolls on until I have something that feels like a sense of a shape of a collection, and then I'll kind of nudge the publisher and go, look, I think I have an idea for the next collection. Can we start to put it in the diary? And then they come back 2 years later.
we're completely out of time. My returning guest tonight is Polly Atkin. She's an award-winning poet and nonfiction writer whose work focuses on nature, place, and disability. We've been talking about her newest collection, which I strongly recommend. It's like no other experience you'll have reading these poems. Emergency Dream. Polly, it's a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.